You were about to tell me why you came to Kentucky, so why don't you start there?
I was born of New England people in southern Michigan, and I was the last one in the family. I had a very active elder brother, 11 years older than I, and my sister was 8 years older than I. And when it came time to pick out colleges, I had known, I guess all my life long, that I was going to take a degree in journalism. Don't know why, but it was just everything that I did came that way.
And that wasn't very common in your time, was it, for a woman to want to be a journalist?
Oh, no, it certainly was not. And that had something to do with why I came to Kentucky. My brother had graduated from Northwestern, and, of course, Medill School of Journalism I was very aware of, but I wasn't very my idea of being Bob Gohman's little sister and Olive Gohman's little sister didn't appeal to me at that point. I was tired of it. He had done everything on the Northwestern campus, and so I didn't even consider there. My sister was working on her master's at the University of Michigan, and I knew that while they would be happy to have me enroll in their school of journalism, I would not be able to expect to work on their newspaper or anything. That was something that the women just weren't allowed to do. It was one of those things that you just knew they wouldn't put up with you on theirs.
So even though your sister was pursuing a master's degree at Michigan, she couldn't work on the paper?
No, and hers was in creative writing.
Ah, okay.
So that cut out two things. And the next place on my list was the University of Kentucky's department. And I knew nothing at all about Kentucky, but one day up in Michigan, I packed my suitcase and said, well, Mother, I'll go and look, and got on the train and came down to Lexington.
Oh, when was that?
That was in the June of 1943. And when I arrived in Lexington, without having had any contact with the school at all or knowing what was going on, and I walked into the hotel down in the Phoenix, the Lafayette. I discovered that it was the weekend of the Junior League Horse Show, and the town was full of people, absolutely full of people. But I looked a little sad and said, well, gee, I'm here to look at the university. And the desk clerk got very active right away and said, you just wait a minute. And he came back in about 10 minutes, and he had a room for me. So I spent my first night in Lexington in a private dining room with 2 Duncan Fife tables and 24 gold chairs and a private bath. Couldn't have asked for anything more. So there I was. And that was my introduction to the fact that people in Kentucky just are very helpful people. I went out to the university and went straight to the Dean of Women's office because I felt that was the best place to start, and met Sarah Bennett Holmes, who was a tremendous woman. And she guided me after talking for 15, 20 minutes. She guided me to Elmer Salzer's office because she felt that as public relations man, he was the best person to take me around campus. And one of the first places he took me, bypassing the journalism department, was to the radio station because
really?
It was his favorite baby.
Ah.
It was his idea. He had been very active in placing the radios in the stores or churches or wherever groups of people in eastern Kentucky could gather around a radio, and was planning and working on how they were going to get the kind of information from those radios that he wanted them to learn.
So had you thought at all about working in radio before that?
Not one word. Not one thing. But Brummel was a very, very persuasive public relations man. I was fascinated, and when I met Lolo Robinson, who was the other faculty member in that station, nobody else but those two people who ran all the rest of us and taught a number of students a great deal, not only about how to run a radio station and what you did and how you found your materials, but how you lived with and worked with other people. I learned so much from Lolo that I have used all my life long. But before I left Kentucky, Lexington, it was about a day and a half I spent there. I had seen everything thanks to Brummel. I knew about the music department. I knew about the journalism department. I had met a few of the professors, but not very many. And before I got on the train to go back home, Brummel offered me a work-study scholarship. So that is how I came to Kentucky. I came with full tuition paid.
Mm-hmm. Was that in part because the war was going on, and is this money that probably under normal circumstances would have gone to men, do you think?
You know, I don't know. The chief announcer, of course, at the station was Betty Ann Giannacchio. She was, I believe, a sophomore then, and an extremely good voice, and she knew her job, and her job in that station was to interview all the people who wanted to work there and choose the ones that she felt had any ability and teach them how to be radio announcers. She taught me when I came in.
And how old were you at this time?
18.
So you had just finished high school and immediately went to, decided you were going to go to the University of Kentucky, came here and visited, saw the radio station, and when you returned to UK in the fall, then you were immediately an employee of the station as well as being a student. Is that right?
Well, I was not an employee of the station as far as money is concerned. I was one of the kids up there. There was Jimmy Heisel. The men who ran the boards and everything were mostly all electrical engineer students. Jimmy Heisel, Bob Westerfield, Hugh Bassett. Those were the ones that I met immediately and who taught me what I knew about the engineering. But we all were student volunteers. The only faculty, the only paid people, the two bosses were Lolo Robinson, whose office was right there on the top floor of McVeigh Hall in the studio. So she was with us all the time. But we were allowed to have ideas to say, gee, Lolo, I think that's a good idea that you have, but could we do it this way? And she'd say, well, go try it. If it works, we'll go your way, and if it doesn't, we'll try my way. And it was a tremendous experience for all of us. There were no classes in radio until my senior year. I believe they started in 47, in the fall of 46, 47. That's when Rusty came back from his 3 or 4 years out in the Pacific and was enrolled in the classes.
Now, when you went back to Michigan before you began your freshman year, is that when you went to Detroit and tried to get your license through the FCC, or was that later?
No, that was later.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that then when the time comes, because that's an interesting story.
Oh, that is. That's a good story.
When you did come back then as a freshman and you were working at the station, what were your duties back then?
Well, back then, first I learned from Betty Ann. We called her Jocko. I was to have regular tutoring classes from her. I was given script after script after script, and I stood in little Studio C, the small, intimate studio that we had, and learned timing. I learned to lower my voice and handle it without having an early morning bit of tendency to cough, as I may, in a little while.
So you mentioned lowering the voice, and it seems that even until fairly recently, probably within the last 20 years, broadcasters had all been taught or told, well, if you smoke cigarettes, you'll get that nice low voice. Did they encourage that at all, or was that something that was just too horrible for a woman to do, would be to smoke a cigarette?
They definitely preferred no smoking at all in the studios. Two or three of the boys did, but none of the women did.
Mm-hmm.
I never smoked a cigarette in my life because my father did not approve.
Good for him.
And what my father did not approve of, one didn't do.
Sure.
It was that era. And it was a wonderful way to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, that first year, it was very, very good for me that the journalism department was on the sort of the, we couldn't quite call it the first floor, between the first floor and the sub-basement of McVeigh Hall. And the bookstore was there in one end, so as we ran through, we could pick up a cold Coca-Cola or anything. And then the radio station was on the top floor of McVeigh Hall, and there was a freight elevator that went back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
That we all used, because my classes were in the English department, which was the third floor of McVeigh, and most of my classes. And between journalism and English classes and the radio station, I was pretty well happy to be right there.
Now, you eventually became an editor with the Kentucky Colonel. Were you working for the Colonel at the same time that you were working for the radio station?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was on the staff right away. I began to, just small stories. But I was learning my way through there. And I also was, as far as I know, aside from the band sponsor, which was always a beauty queen, I was the first woman to be enrolled as a member of the marching band at the University of Kentucky in fall of 1943. It was an ROTC uniformed arm of the music department.
And what instrument did you play?
The bass drum.
I don't suppose there were too many other women playing bass drum then, were there?
No, and I don't know of any other women who were not only willing but insisted that they carry their own bass drum when it weighed about 45 pounds and I weighed 95.
That must have been something to see. Do you have pictures?
Yes.
You have to share some of those with us. I would love to see that. Well, getting back to the station, what were you doing for the station? You were covering news, I presume, for the Kentucky Colonel. Were you also doing news broadcasts on WBKY, or were you announcing, or what was your role here?
In the beginning, if there were some small things, I was allowed to announce. You had to know what you were doing before you did it. Later on that year, I became a regular announcer, just introducing and closing programs. Excuse me, I hate dead air, but I have to think. I also, we did a lot of dramatic productions in the first 3 or 4 years there. And I am a pretty good actress. So I worked with Lolo, who directed most of those. In fact, she found the scripts and wrote a number of them, I'm sure, but we also had some people on campus, students, who were learning just on their own to do radio scripts. And we did lots of good things at that time.
Were these adaptations of novels, or were they original stories, or what kind of radio dramas were these?
Most of them were original.
Mm. Now, the one that I'm the most familiar with is the Christmas play that was done in conjunction with the music school and with John Jacob Niles. Were you involved in that?
I was there when John Jacob Niles came in and probably did the major part of the rote announcing on that. I had been through my scholarship had moved from the radio station to the music department.
Ah.
For the bass drum playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a great deal of the things that I was writing, I covered all the Sunday afternoon concert series and any news that was coming out of the music department for the Colonel. And when the band and the symphony came up to make discs, and anybody came that was of statewide interest that we had performing at the station, I was there not only to introduce them to Lolo and to the people, but on the air.
Did you take classes with Niles, or did you just work with him on the Christmas play?
He was only a visiting artist when I was there.
What was he like?
He was a very, very interesting man. He was big and burly and quite Eastern Kentucky, and we loved him, and he could tell stories for hours, and did, and I don't know how many of them ever got on the air.
Mm. Yeah, we were trying to look around to see if there was a copy of the Christmas play somewhere, and we haven't been able to find a recording of it. I believe the script still exists, and we're actually talking about recreating that maybe for Christmas this year.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I think it would be fun to take that old script and bring some people from the music school over here and do that over, since radio drama is kind of a lost art, and I've always been fascinated by it.
Oh, it's wonderful. You can do more things when you let your listening audience use their own imaginations instead of just giving them pictures to look at.
Yeah, and so much of that has been lost in the modern media with television and cameras going everywhere. It's something that at least National Public Radio and public radio stations like WUKY are trying to keep alive. Tell me more about the radio station in those early days. FM radios were not very common. Were there people, just general public, who listened to the station, or was all of this programming specifically designed as education, where the university would take these massive radios out into the hills and provide education to people, what we now call distance learning?
When I first began, most of the programs that were aired beyond just campus were put onto 16-inch discs. They were cut. That was the way that we kept everything. There wasn't a tape heard of at that point, and shipped to WHAS, which was Clear Channel from Louisville. It went overnight in a hard-backed suitcase sort of thing, briefcase that we sent all our discs up to WHAS, and they aired them. They spent a lot of time, particularly on Saturday mornings, airing programs that were interviews with people, professors from many different areas and campus. I know the ag shows were always very well, because HAS had been working with FM, and there were enough people out in the state with FM radios that I believe we were pretty well listened to. I know that, and then they shipped the discs back to us. And talking about women on the air, the discs came back and we unpacked the suitcase one of those days, a Saturday afternoon, and the Heisel took the discs out, and there was a note attached to one. The note read, and I don't know why, it never occurred to me to say, hey, I want to keep this. The note from the announcers up at WHAS said, you know, we listened to your show today, and we just want to say that Casey would be a damned good announcer if she just weren't a woman.
Oh, wow.
And we laughed.
Yeah, well, good. At least you had a sense of humor about it.
Well, you just had a sense of humor at that point in time.
Did you think about pursuing broadcasting as a career after you left UK?
Well, when I left UK, I married Rusty, who had come back. And would you like to hear how I met that man?
Yes, please, tell us.
Okay, by this time, I was no longer chief announcer. I was chief producer at the station. We were doing a great deal more, and the station was on the air, and we had to keep all day's things going, and it was a very responsible position, for which I earned $12 a month, which was nice handy. $12 a month down in the basement for being the managing editor of the Kernel, $12 a month upstairs, and I had $25 of spending money every single month, which was heavenly. But I had to go up to the station every morning and check and make sure everybody who was going to come to their assignments and so on. I walked in to the reception room one morning with my arms full of books, and some of my friends and some strangers were all male, were horsing around waiting for class to begin. And one of my friends, with whom I'd worked for 3.5 years, turned around and said, "Hi, Casey," and picked me up. I mean, an arm under my knees and an arm around my shoulders. I was not expecting this, and I couldn't do anything because my hands were full. And he threw me to this good-looking stranger. And it was Rusty.
And what was he doing at the station at the time?
He was there as a student. They had begun classes that year, and he was there to take one of his regular classes.
And you had not seen him before?
No, I hadn't. I had no reason to. But anyway, and up in the radio station from the very beginning, we never dated each other. We ran around as a group. And I also had this strong feeling that I couldn't be the boss and say, "Yes, you can do that. No, you can't do that," if I was dating anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very well known that don't waste your time. So anyway, Rusty caught me and set me down, and the bell rang, and he went on to class, and as he walked in, Hugh looked at him and said, "Oh, Rusty, you'd met Casey, hadn't you?" And Rusty said, "No." And Hugh proceeded to tell him, "Well, don't worry about it. I mean, she's a nice girl, but she won't date anybody up here." Rusty had two dates that he'd made before he met me, and I had two dates that I'd made before I met him, and that was that. We dated all year and married in September.
Also, you violated your own policy of not dating anyone.
Mm-hmm, I sure did.
Well, good thing you did. How long have you been married?
It'll be 58 years in September.
Wow. And all this because someone tossed you to him.
Mm-hmm. That was the beginning. And there are several people in Kentucky who will remember that.
Well, it's a good thing you were light enough for someone to do that.
Yes.
You mentioned being just 95 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was running around doing so many things on campus that I didn't have time to. In fact, the cook at the sorority house used to meet me coming down as I was running downstairs to go to my 8 o'clock class with my two or three strips of bacon wrapped in two pieces of toast, and she'd say, "Now, Miss Casey, I want you to eat this for your breakfast as you go." Back to your question.
You've mentioned holding a couple of different titles at the station, chief announcer and chief producer. So what you started working as a freshman. How did your role in the station evolve? What different titles did you hold, and what did you do for the station?
Well, I was an announcer and began working in the dramas. Anything that Lolo asked me to do, I would say, "Sure, I'll try." And it just evolved as the need came along. When Betty Ann Giannacchio got involved in more on-campus things, student government and a number of things that she did, and also working in the Guignol Theater, it was time for somebody else to become chief announcer. And you have to remember that we didn't have a whole lot of students who were capable at that time. Because we didn't have very many men at all. They were just beginning to come back from the service. And it was simply a matter of, Jocko said, I'm just going to leave at the end of this semester. And Lolo said, Casey, will you do this? And I did. And that's the way things evolved.
And that was when? Which year in your tenure at the university?
Probably I started as a rising sophomore doing that. I'm not quite sure.
And then after that, is that when you became the chief producer?
After that, the end of my junior year probably and through my senior year.
And were those the only titles you had at the station?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We weren't big on titles. They didn't really mean anything to us.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, now that's an alternative to giving someone a raise, is you give them a nice title.
Well, we didn't have to worry about raises either. We knew what the budget was. Something happened along in there that we haven't talked about. The war was going great guns, and we had a discussion one day. The two guys in the engineering end, Jim Heisel and Hugh Bassett. We may have talked about this on the way up because it was the summer of 1944 when they wanted to get their third-class licenses. And I got the third-class. They got their first-class licenses. But the only place that in east of the Mississippi that you could take those tests was in Detroit. And fortunately, I grew up 72 miles from Detroit. So when I went home for the summer, they went up, we rode the bus all the way to Detroit and went in to take our license exams. The two men, two young, unserviced at that point, neither one of them were in the service. These two young engineering students coming in were greeted with open arms and given their everything to fill out, and then you start and we'll put you in these two rooms and so on. And then they turned to me and said, well, now this is going to take probably 4 or 5 hours. What are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to take my third class examination. And they looked at me as if I was quite out of my mind. And what was I? Was I in the engineering school? I said, no, I'm in the journalism school.
But back in those days, and even when I started in broadcasting in the 1970s, you had to know some basic electronics in order to get a third-class license, and you had to be able to perform routine calculations and read meters, and it wasn't, as it is now, anyone can walk in off the street and operate a radio station, but back then you actually had to know something.
Mm-hmm. And I'd read all the books. I knew all the yes, no's, and maybe answers. And these engineering students had been, and the one professional from WLAP who came in and sort of oversaw, read our meters and signed the log every so often, they'd been teaching me. I'd been doing this all the time that I'd been there.
Mm-hmm.
You just absorbed everything. So I knew what I was doing. I was not upset about, you know, I didn't feel nervous. I just, well, I have to take a test. So I took a test. So I surprised them. I knew all the answers.
So you passed the first time?
Certainly.
And I don't suppose they'd seen too many women in that testing office before you.
I don't believe they had.
You earlier referred to the old-fashioned method of recording programs on 16-inch transcription discs.
Yes.
And we talked before this conversation about these recorders and about the discs themselves. So talk a little bit about that process of how that worked and how volatile these materials were that you were recording on.
Well, they were wax. And as you had the recording process going on, all these little, thin, almost like silk threads kept coming off the disc. It cut all the grooves. And there was a large tin can, about a coffee can size, I would guess, right up there next to the heads. And you picked up this and you pushed it down, and it was very carefully. You never left the control room that was not emptied into a fire-safe container and disposed of. I can't remember what we did with it, but we did whatever we were taught and made sure that there would never be a fire starting in our control room.
Yeah, when we spoke with Rusty before, he said that if a flame got in contact with that material, it would just burst into flame immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea I've seen these discs, and we still have some here on campus that were recorded back then.
I hope you do.
But I had no idea that the materials they were made of were that volatile.
Well, you could take them downstairs all the way out into the middle of the street and pile them up and drop either a cigarette butt or a match into them. If you were sure that Lolo had gone home.
That's not a prank that you did too often, I suppose.
No, we didn't do it too often, but we knew it was a good way to get rid of it. During the period that the war in Europe was pulling to a close, really, probably we started during the build-up to VE Day. We had one other woman who was an engineering major, Maureen Taylor, a very close friend of mine. Her husband, whose name was Royce Taylor, had been in the engineering department at UK and ROTC and was in the Pacific. Maureen had the grasp of, she spoke French and like a native, she spoke some German, and with her French she was very, very able to keep up with Spanish and Italian if she had to. But we decided that there needed to be some documentation of the materials that were coming to us over the helicopter shortwaves in our our racks of what was going on in Europe. And for almost 2 weeks, we manned that radio station 24/7. Now, and we made recordings of every new important newscast on those big 16-inch discs.
Mm-hmm.
We had to have permission for Maureen, Casey, and another young woman engineer, Betty Peters, to come and go at the station. She gave us permission that we could arrive at 7 o'clock in the morning. We could stay until 7 o'clock in the evening, but we could not be there from 7 to 7. She was not going to have any of her young women stay up there with all those young men overnight. And we said, we understand, we thank you, we were glad to go home and sleep in bed instead of on the couches in the reception room. But between 3 or 4 of the men and Maureen and Casey and Betty Peters, we made those recordings from VE Day all the way to the time when Maureen was listening, and I saw her eyes get real big, and she began to, and she pointed for us to drop the needle on the disc, and it was Winston Churchill himself saying, "My friends, the war is over." Now, I don't know where those discs are.
Yeah, I haven't encountered any of that material. You know, many of these discs, if not stored properly, could have deteriorated to the point where there wasn't even any of the wax material on them anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know what became of those. There were a few here at the station when I came here last year, and I've turned those over to the library.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like that. It would have been amazing to have put that on a turntable and hear Winston Churchill's voice come out of it.
Yeah. Mm. The war is over.
How did you feel when you heard those words?
You had goosebumps and the tears flowed. And this had been going on with us. In the first place, in order to finance this little thing we had been doing, we all put our money together. And when we girls left, we figured out what we needed to have to eat the next day and bought it and brought it in as much as we could. But the social work department was at the other end of the top floor there at McVeigh. And their professor, their head, all wandered in every once in a while to see what was going on. And he became really very worried about these students over here, that we were doing so much and it was getting to be so tense and we were all so tired. And he worried and he worried, but he knew if Lolo approved, he couldn't stop us. But that afternoon, when it was announced that the war was over, he picked up the telephone and called his wife. And within about an hour and a half, she arrived with cauldrons of soup and pasta. She'd cooked everything she had in her kitchen and brought it to us. And he came in with these steaming kettles and put down the paper plates and the napkins in the reception room and said, "Now, you all sit down and eat."
Were there, I assume there were celebrations on campus that were going on at the same time, weren't there?
They were beginning. And as soon as we ate voraciously, we had, I don't know if you have it still, Bromo had a very large train brass bell in our department. And we wheeled that out of the sound effects cupboard, put it on the elevator, took it down to the street because the ASTP boys were in the men's dorm right across the street. And they were not allowed to get out and celebrate, by the way. Their colonel told them that they had to, it was study period, and they jolly well better stay and study. We wheeled that great, huge bell up and down the street, beating it like mad. There was a great celebration.
Mm.
But, I have never forgotten the social work department at the University of Kentucky.
I guess not. That's wonderful.
And I know that all the discs that we made at that time were in Lolo's possession when I left, when I graduated. And Maureen had graduated, and she and her husband, she were on, when the war was over in the Pacific, he was still posted to Okinawa, I think. We lost touch over the years. I've met him at UK things two or three times, but I don't know, what happened. There were some fairly quick turnovers, I think, there for a while.
Yeah. Well, I'll certainly have another look at the library at some point. I toured the archives in the basement of the King Library when I first came here, and we didn't find a lot of WBKY material, but I've, in some cases with libraries going back that far, they don't even know what they have. So I'll certainly renew the search to see if any of this stuff can be found.
A long time ago in this conversation, you asked me if I had considered using my experience or my degrees professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Rusty and another friend of his, but Rusty, came to UK knowing pretty exactly what he wanted to do, and that was to take a degree in radio advertising, which was not offered. So he sat down and went through all the journalism, the radio, and school of commerce, picked out every single course that he thought was applicable and useful, put them all together, and the professor that had to pass on these things was the chair of the philosophy department, Dr. Kuiper. And he sat down with Rusty, and Rusty presented his case, and my husband is a very good salesman. He was granted permission to take a topical major. And the other man who picked up on this, a friend of ours, Dee Huddleston, who, if you've only been in UK for a couple of years, has been senator, United States Senator for a number of years, from E-Town, Elizabethtown. He and Dee were granted the first two topical majors in radio advertising on the campus.
Huh.
So, when he went out, his first job was with a newspaper up on the shore of Lake Michigan. And we lived there, and then he came back who he was a native-born Louisvillian. He came back to Louisville and went to work in the advertising department of KYW. It was the first music and news station in Kentucky. Mm. Would you rather talk to Rusty about this?
Yeah, let's bring him on in a minute. Let me finish up a couple of things with you. Okay. I just wanted to come back to something you had mentioned, that a lot of the early programming on WBKY consisted of interviews with professors and other prominent people on campus and in town. Mm-hmm. Did you do any of those interviews yourself?
When necessary.
And are there any that you remember or anything that stands out in your mind?
Well, I remember one time, and this is not a professor on campus, but I walked up to announce whatever the interview was going to be one afternoon, probably 1946. The war in Europe certainly was over. And I walked into the station, into the reception room, and was introduced to the foreign war correspondent who was going to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, he and my brother had grown up together in Detroit, and his little sister and I were born within 3 weeks or so of the same time. His name was David Nickel. He and his family and my family, his father was a Presbyterian minister, and he'd been the minister of the church my family attended. So we immediately had lots of bonds, and I ended up sitting in on that interview and asking questions about what he had done and how he managed to stay in Berlin all the way through the war, and he get chased to the border with fair frequency, but always managed. He stayed in that country and reported from that country, and things like that. But most of the interviews were done by professionals. If it was from the ag school, it was a professional interviewing a man who was the expert in what they wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I introduced, thanked, and closed.
Okay. Are there other memories of those early days of WBKY that you'd like to share with us?
I think you have the highlights pretty much.
Okay.
We did the thing that meant so much to that little group that worked there from 43 through 47 was the fact that we were treated like adults, not like experimental kids. If we thought we could do something, we pretty much, they knew that we'd figured out whether we could or not before we brought it to the adults. Lola Robinson acted like a mother to all of us. When you went to school in those days, unless you lived in Louisville or somewhere that close, you went in September and you went home for Christmas and you came back to school and then you went home at the end of the spring semester. So when it came to be Thanksgiving or birthdays, things like that, you were on campus. You didn't have a family background. But in the radio station you did, because you had Lolo. She had us all out at her house, for she was the widow of a professor. She took care of us as if we were all her own children, if the boys went out to the racetrack and made a little money on a few horses, and they came in on Monday morning chuckling and waving their money around. They didn't wave it very long because they gave it to Lolo to keep, so they wouldn't spend it all right away. It was that kind of a background from which we went to being full-blown graduate adults. I went to work. In fact, I went to work about a month before I graduated for WLEX as an assistant to the manager. And then after we married, I worked at WLAP writing copy for a year or so. And then during the years we have been married, I have written copy as a sideline for every station, whether Rusty was selling advertising or he went to Henderson, Kentucky, and was the manager of the stations there, WSON, AM and FM. And I handled the out of station things. I always went to the courthouse on election night. In fact, there they had a lovely arrangement with the newspaper, the Gleaner Journal, and the head newsman for the Gleaner Journal, who was completely incapacitated. He had arthritis so badly he lay on his back, and the announcement, the microphone just came over his head and dropped down when he needed to give them anything. But he also wrote most of the news for the newspaper. And when I came to town, the society editor, who was a really big thing then, went on a 3-week vacation in September, always. And I was asked if I would please do her job for 3 weeks every September. And that was fun. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Okay. But I did that sort of thing always. I'd write copy, and then as we came along, and when we were in, certainly the last 10 years, when we were in Charleston, Illinois, and Rusty owned the station, I would do my job as assistant to the director of the university library for 8 hours, and 3 days a week I was teaching introduction to journalism in the J department, because they didn't have a token woman and they were up for accreditation. So they hired me. I'd leave. My boss was very understanding. He'd say, "Sure, Casey, go." So I'd go from there to the J department, and then back. Then I'd go out to the radio station and write copy for an hour or so, and I would cart it, because Rusty had some people in town who would sign contracts if Casey would do their copy. They liked to listen to me on the air.
Mm-hmm.
I did that with every station, and you well know how much you move around when you're going up in the radio business.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were in, when we were in Dayton, when three different times in my lifetime, I have worked for the radio school things, you know, come and we'll teach you to be radio announcers or writing copy or anything. And I would teach radio speech there. The ones in Dayton, they'd come back to me after they they'd graduated and tell me about their jobs and how wonderful it was to know what they were doing, and because I can take, I can still take a terrible voice and a very nasty colloquial accent, Rusty's telling me. And if the person is willing to do what I tell them and work, I can pretty much erase that accent in 3 to 4 months of 2 or 3 classes a week.
Well, we could certainly use you here these days, and a lot of radio stations could use that kind of talent.
I learned well way back in the very beginning, and I never forgot what I learned.
It's a lost art now. So many people come into broadcasting with poor voices or with regional accents, and they're never taught how to do it any differently.
Mm-hmm.
They
don't. In the first place, they have to know that they want to change, or they have to know that they need to change, and then they have to be willing to work at it. And of course, the year and a half that I was also after we married and Rusty still had a couple years to make up. He's 6 months older than I am, but I got out of school ahead of him because of the war. I was the assistant to Wally Briggs at Guignol Theater there on campus. And I learned a great deal about teaching speech patterns from Wally, because he was a very, very good man. He was the director of the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've used everything I have learned in every venue that I've tried my whole life long. Since I graduated, I just never went out and got this job or that job, because I've enjoyed the variety of my life.
That sounds like you've had quite a bit of that.
Well, you know, in the Henderson, Kentuckys, and the Charleston, Illinois, and the towns of that size and in that size venue, you move into a town, your husband as the manager or the owner belongs to all the things that the men have to do or do, and the women, if they blend at all, will do the hospital auxiliaries, the women's clubs, all these things, and pretty much always you're asked to edit the newsletter. And you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're asked to make the announcements and do all that sort of thing. And if they do a program or they do a theatrical thing, you're asked to be in that, because that's where they expect you, as the wife of your husband, to fit in. And it never bothered me at all that these opportunities all came my way because I was the wife of my husband, because I thought that was a good job for me to have.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to do this, and you've made me feel like I've been time traveling, because I feel like I was actually here at the station during World War II and hearing those words of Winston Churchill. So that was a very vivid story, and I want to thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.